What is one thing people tend to get wrong about Leonardo da Vinci?
That he was a polymath and he did lots of different things, which in a sense he did, but the things for him are all related. Mm. I've been saying he's a manic monomath, i.e. he sees all these diverse phenomena as part of a single central kind of organizing principle, which is quite a modern view in a way. But and the other one, which is a real cliche, I must get this in, he's a man ahead of his time, which is, it comes up and up and up. In fact, he used the resources of his time more imaginatively and to a greater reach than anybody had done. But the dynamic theory he's using, i.e. the theory of moving bodies, and all that theoretical framework is basically medieval, late medieval. And it's very potent. I mean, we always think of medieval as not very good at science, but there's a lot of very important science, particularly optical science, in the Latin Middle Ages and in Islamic science as well.
Mm. And why do we have this notion that he's a polymath and he's a jack of all trades? Why has that come to fruition?
I think it's a factor of what happened in the 19th century when all the various disciplines and even sub-disciplines were setting themselves up as nameable subjects. 19th century, you can get the great classifications of knowledge. Obviously, people wrote about plants before and about animals. But you've got the Royal College of this, the Royal College of that, high professionalism and the qualifications and so on. So you take that splitting up of all these areas that he saw as essentially unified, and they then refract back into these classifications that we were avidly putting on things in the 19th century and still am. Mm. If you go into a science department now, you'll probably see four or five new names on doors because they're always renaming. The humanities don't. Paradoxically, it's the sciences who rewrite their titles and the humanities who don't. But I think you put those two things together. The Leonardo's diversity in the classification of knowledge via teaching institutions and so on, you get this sense that he is doing matters of different things by our standards.
Mm. And you refer to him more as a monomath. What topic or expertise would you say he's monomaniacally focused on?
There's almost nothing he doesn't... He doesn't embrace in some shape or form, even if it's only the plan of the book or a few questions. Leonardo, you probably hold this old saw that if you know somebody somewhere in the world, you're only seven places removed from them or whatever.
Yeah.
The number is. With Leonardo's knowledge, it works like that. If he's looking at water, he thinks about the curling of hair.
Mm.
If he thinks about curling of hair, he thinks about portraying an angel, et cetera, et cetera. So there's an infinite expansion of analogous phenomena of observations. And he's always capable of seeing something as something else. He doesn't essentially observe something as a separate entity. It's always part of a bigger spectrum of visual things, how they work, how we see them, how they operate, their form, their colour, their activities, and their significance as well.
Mm. Yeah. And are there any surprising facts about Leonardo da Vinci that most people don't know that you've uncovered?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I don't think in terms of a great overarching thing. I think I would say if I've accomplished anything in my time with Leonardo studies, it's seeing him whole.
Mm.
Rather than seeing him as atomized and... You get a sense for how he sees the cosmos, the world, the microcosmos. Man is a microcosmos, a miniature cosmos, and embeds in his or her body all the elements that go to constitute the universe as a whole. And looking at rivers, he thinks about blood vessels and so on. That's that expansion of into other fields, which we regard as rather separate.
Mm.
You wouldn't necessarily expect an expert in weirs and locks in water to be involved with heart surgery. That's exactly what Leonardo does. I find it wonderfully thrilling because it goes from subject to subject in this very seductive way. It can be a bit frustrating sometimes. You go from one thing to another, and he's not finished the previous thing.
Yeah,
no more to be said. And you say, "Stay there, that Leonardo. You know, let's do that. And then we'll move on." But now he's off and doing something else. So it's his spontaneous move across subjects on an intuitive basis is a delight. It's a great source of pleasure and insight. It's sort of very frustrating. You sometimes feel, say, Leonardo, come on, get on with it. Let's finish that bit and we'll do this bit and it'll be wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it took him to TV producer, Barmy.
Yeah, and it's amazing how he can apply the different interests he has to another thing and cross-link them together where there may have not been, relationship between them before. An example that popped to mind when you were talking about that was his obsession with the swirling of water. And then when he was studying the heart, he used that kind of, I don't know if he used it, but he had the insight that that swirling of the blood could help close the artery vessels. So it's just amazing how he can link different things together and apply these different things to his work, right?
Absolutely, yeah. The heart, Frank Wells, the surgeon, has written a very good book on Leonardo's heart, and he's very alert to how knowledge in other areas, with the microcosm, if you've proved something in relation to the microcosm, you could take it into other areas. And the heart valves are a case in point. He observed that they're actually operated by the vortices of the heart, of the blood. They've got no muscles there. They're not closing. The tricuspid valves are not closing spontaneously by dint of muscular action. The heart valves are working according to the laws of what we call hydrodynamics, so there was no such word at that time. And he looks at weirs on rivers and looks at the way the water flows through them and then expands. And he's got the idea that the neck of the aorta operates, but it's quite narrow, gets compressed, it expands, it goes back in volutes and closes the valve. It's a bit like Harvey, in a sense. He learned about the valves and the veins by looking at Pound's locks, these locks which have great gates which push out in a point. So, and he's doing exactly the same thing. He's saying, well, you know, we know from the way the valves and the veins work how that is driven. You drive the blood through and it can't come back. Leonardo's valves, you drive it through and it can't come back. I'm not saying he anticipated Harvey. They're able to think laterally from one area of knowledge to another. This is something which on the whole modern science is less good at than it is at other things.
Yeah. And I have to talk about the most expensive painting ever sold in history. The Salvator Mundi was sold for $450 million and attributed to Leonardo da Vinci. And am I correct in saying that you played quite a pivotal role in this controversial attribution?
No, I was involved. Whether you call it pivotal is a matter of judgment. No, I saw it very early on because Robert Simon, one of the dealers who had bought it, two dealers bought it, and another dealer came in. And they hadn't bought it thinking it was a Leonardo. They thought it might be an interesting schoolwork, and it was quite damaged and infilled and overpainted and so on. It was only when Diane Modestini, a very distinguished conservator, started cleaning off the varnish, she thought, there's something going on here. And I saw it fairly early. I saw it initially in the National Gallery, in the conservation studio where it was being kept securely and also looked at. And when I went in to see it, there were two or three other scholars there, including Pietro Morani from Italy. And it was an odd moment because you walked in and the painting has a presence. Leonardo paintings, and it sounds like Sood's Corner, but they do have a presence, almost a living, breathing presence. And the copyist couldn't do that. He did it with glaze after glaze of painting, which means the painting vibrates with different different lights. And it was, you know, it's unnerving. Do I go and greet my friends, the fellow Leonardo scholars, or what do I do? So I took out my magnifying glass, which makes you look like a professional. And I went up and I scrutinized the surface of it. And then I could speak to the others. But it was unnerving. And all the time you have to say, there's been no new Leonardo discovered for over 100 years. Wait a minute. No, don't jump at it, because to some extent you always see what you want to see.
Yeah.
We all do that in our lives.
Yeah.
It's a human thing that seeing is heavily directed by what we want to see. And to see something absolutely plainly and clearly is a major act.
Mm.
So all the time you're saying, assume this is not right, and say, what's wrong with it and why is it wrong?
Mm.
I used to do an exercise with graduate students with Michelangelo in a Michelangelo drawing. And it was a perfectly authentic drawing of one of the pretty young men he befriended in Rome. And I said, well, you know that Michelangelo doesn't do portraits, so what's wrong with this image here? They show you, look at the hand, that's not very good. Look at the ear, that's not very good. And we so demolished the picture, and it's absolutely cast iron Michelangelo.
Mm.
I stopped doing it. It was really messing up people's ability to look at this drawing properly. But that was an indication to them and to anybody that seeing is a very partial and directed business. It's not arbitrary, but it's full of all sorts of snares and things that you can get carried away with.
Mm. Yeah, confirmation bias is a powerful thing. Do you believe Da Vinci was the sole creator of the Salvator Mundi? And why is the attribution disputed?
Yeah, I'm convinced most of what we see there, or if we took the picture when it was stripped down, when there was no infilling or overpaint in it, that the majority, if not all of that, is by Leonardo.
Mm.
It has a subtlety and a power which the best of the copyists don't get. As much copied as an image, it's very famous. And they all just missed that extraordinary edge. I got involved when it was coming towards Christie's auction. There was so much rubbish being circulated about it, really just terrible. And I made a film for Christie's saying what I thought it was and what to look for. I didn't take any money for that. That wasn't part of the selling, but I'd rather that I pronounced in public so people could get an idea of what it was or what I thought it was, rather than just having a field day. It's very difficult in attribution. First of all, a new Leonardo, as I said, one hasn't come along for 100 years, so it's got a lot of work to do. I think that the Ginevra da Benci, the portrait in Washington, came up now. We find it pretty hard to attribute that to Leonardo, but it's established itself. And over a period of time, the core images, probably no more than 20 of them, have established themselves as the canon of Leonardo.
Mm.
It's difficult to get into that. The other are rather personal reasons, that there are people who weren't invited to see it when it first emerged. There are people who got involved with the attribution of it, and there were filmmakers making films, one of which was rather good, but almost all the main interviews were with people who just did silly things and made silly pronouncements. And they, of course, are good television.
Mm.
If I give a few boring truths, nobody much falls over and thinks that's terrific. If somebody comes up with a ridiculous beating a copy of the Salvator Mundi with a stick,
yeah,
that's good television. It happens to be bad knowledge, but it's good television.
Mm. And do you think the, controversy and the uncertainty helped it become so expensive? Like, if it's not 100% made by Leonardo da Vinci and we can't actually ever confirm that it was made by him, how did it fetch such a high price?
Well, at that point, it was being handled by Christie's. We'd got my pronouncements as far as anybody listened to them. And generally, there was a sense that it was Leonardo. The opposition grew subsequently. I think partly when it was bought for this money, you show your superior qualities by saying this $450 million object is not Leonardo. And there were people making a good deal of public reputation by doing that. And it was in the National Gallery exhibition, and it then disappeared.
Mm.
The rumours are that it's in Arab ownership, Mohammed bin Salman, but I haven't got evidence of that. If you say, do I know where it is? The answer is I don't. I can guess, and guess fairly productively like other people, but we actually don't know. There's no hard evidence. So there's a sense, I think, a rather unpleasant sense of saying, look what these silly Arabs have done. They're paying all this money for a picture and they don't even know it's not by Leonardo. there are complicated things come in. The attribution of a work of art is a loaded thing anyway.
Yeah.
The owner or the gallery wants it to be the best it can. So it's already got quite a lot of top loading. Then you've got all these other things come in, other factors. And it becomes a vehicle for silly opinions, prejudices, and so on.
Mm. Yeah. And are there people that will know where it is? And why isn't it being disclosed? Because how do they know it's not being destroyed if no one knows where it is?
Yeah, we can't say it's not being destroyed. But,
wow.
But the people in the Middle East, the United Arab Emirates, Dubai, etc., the outlier of the Louvre, which is there, sort of floating in water, it's actually a miraculous building. A good collection with loans from the Louvre, Louvre Abu Dhabi. That's in Abu Dhabi, and that shows that they're very interested in the works of art as art, not necessarily in terms of devotional terms. But my experience of those regimes in Abu Dhabi and so on is that you've got people who are very open and flexible and prepared to discuss things at a certain level. When it gets up beyond that level, when you're getting towards the rulers, the ruling house and so on, governing house, then things become rather sticky. I'm not saying that in a vicious way. People have a right to privacy if they wish to do so. But it is quite difficult to get an inside opinion.
Mm-hmm.
People have said, oh, yeah, we saw it. It's in Balsamon's yacht. I concocted a PowerPoint slide sitting in a photograph as an interior, so I've put it in there, but I've got no evidence for that.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, if it is in there, the yacht doesn't sink.
Yeah, that's a thought.
Yeah.
That's quite a small yacht, the one that sank.
Okay. And what was Da Vinci's childhood like, if we can go back to that? And how did this influence his later life?
We know spectacularly little about Leonardo as a child. We've got the bare facts. We've got his birth, which is attested by his grandfather records that his son, Piero da Vinci, gave birth or was born to him a boy with a woman called Caterina, who was a peasant. Various of us identified her as differently, but she was not a person. Leonardo's father was a very conspicuous lawyer. They were a good, solid, middle-class stock, and Sir Piero da Vinci, the lawyer, had big reputation. He dealt with the Medici and people like this. He was obviously taught to read and write. He probably wasn't taught Latin, which was the thing that a lawyer needed to know, because he was illegitimate and you couldn't take up the lawyer's profession if you're illegitimate. There are plenty of other professions available to him. We know he's living in his grandfather's house. I think it was 4 years after his birth, and he seems to be particularly attached to and encouraged by an uncle called Francesco.
Yeah,
his father's brother, who didn't have any children, And when Francesco died, he left his property to Leonardo, which the legitimate sons disputed, but it's an evidence that Francesco was supportive. But in terms of solid content, we can construct a bare skeleton of where he was and who was involved. But we don't know about his education. There's almost no evidence at all. It's not until he goes to Florence and he gets some sort of public records that we get some flesh to put on the bones.
Have you read that he apparently wrote the wrong way round because he was left-handed and he didn't want to smudge the paper? And that, I know he didn't write in Latin, but he wrote in Italian, right?
Yeah.
Wait, hold that thought. I'm genuinely so grateful that you've stuck around with us to listen to these fascinating insights from the guest so far. If this episode has given you one piece of knowledge which has helped you understand yourself and the world a little bit better than before, the absolute best way to support us is to pay it forward and hit the share button right now. Don't let this knowledge stay hidden. Please send it to one person who will benefit from this episode. Thank you so much. Let's dive back into the rest of the episode.
Now, his writing is very extraordinary. The style of the writing is that of merchant and lawyer's Italian. It's got lots of abbreviations, and it's a crabby, difficult hand. But the people who used it regularly knew how to read it. It's not a code. It's just doing. And he did that writing. He did it left to front.
Yes, yeah.
He did it right to left. Rather, he did it back to front. And some left-handers can do that. First of all, it's the first thing to say. If I'm lecturing, I always say, "Oh, yeah, you can look at this. It's in his mirror script." And I never explain it in the lecture because it gives the first questioner something to get going on. So I sort of seed a question, as it were. And we don't know absolutely why it is, but it's the case that left-handers, particularly ones who have been asked to write right-handed, will write in mirror script, and some can even go out like that. You know, they can do two lines at once.
Wow!
So it is a known thing, and he is. And you had the right suggestion there. The chalks are very smudgeable. The ink is very slow drying, and he's wanting to. Some of the notebooks are tiny, so he's working, you know, really intensely and very fast. You don't want your hand, you don't want to have to be hooking over to write like that. So I think it's a combination of convenience, individual convenience of Leonardo, and genetic predisposition to left-handedness and being able to write back to front.
Mm. And what was your childhood like, and why were you so interested in Leonardo? What inspired you to get interested in him?
Well, I kept clear of Leonardo. I went to a rather ambitious state school that measures its success by getting people into Oxbridge or getting state scholarships. And I did both, so I was in a privileged position. And I went off to Cambridge. I went off there to do natural sciences and not art history. In fact, my knowledge of art when I went there was very little, but I think one of the points of universities, and particularly Oxford and Cambridge, is you learn so much from fellow undergraduates. Mm. Always somebody who knew more about art, more about film, more about music than I did. So I spent a lot of time playing sport and not doing much work. But we had John Cleese was doing the cabaret, and the later director of the National Theatre was producing the plays and so on. So terrific. I learned a terrific amount from fellow undergraduates who better than I was and knew more than I did. So that's where I got my big education from. Having done 2 years of art history and lurked in the back of the new art history lectures, I decided I'd want to take a part two last year at Cambridge in history of art, which is what I did.
Mm. And how easy was it for you to pivot to that degree if you were doing natural sciences beforehand? Was it a tough decision?
Well, one sort of answer is I wasn't doing much natural science which helped. And with a mathematician friend of myself, John Sharp, who's now professor of mathematics in Kent, we went to a lot of lectures. Lectures were just starting in art history. They had the Slade professor, which was an annual appointment, but the regular departmental lectures were just starting in a relatively small lecture room. So it was conspicuous that these two coves were sitting at the back. And Michael Jaffe, the head of art history, didn't know who we were. He couldn't kick us out, but he was somewhat perturbed by having these two people turning up every week. And he went to do art history, I needed to see him and get an okay. I always got on well with him. He was a posh bully, but he didn't know how to handle me. I was a grammar school sports player, and I was completely outside his range of influence. So he's very supportive. I went out to the King's, the Gibbs building in King's College, and I had to see him to say, I want to take art history, can I do so? And I went up this grand staircase and knocked on the most promising door, and a voice said, go in. Somewhere down the line, and I knocked on another door, which turned out to be the toilet. And eventually I got to the astonishing room with these great semicircular windows overlooking the Cam. The room was full of antique furniture, works of art, Rubens' oil sketches and things like that. And he said, sit down. And I thought, I'm not sure I can sit on any of these chairs. They're art gallery chairs. Anyway, I managed to find one which looked reasonably indestructible and sat in it. And I said, I'd like to do art history. He said, I think you better.
Yeah.
There wasn't much more to the interview than that.
Yeah.
In the back.
Yeah.
These things that you rationalize them later in life, but I think most people would agree if they start probing motives, they would say, well, a lot of it was simply accident.
I was speaking to a psychiatrist yesterday, actually, and we were talking about that, how we think we're so rational and logical, but it's often we post-rationalize things. Like, we don't really. It's just interesting how that's the case. But what do you think drives us? Is it just chance and instinct in the moment?
Yes, I think I would say almost the chief ability you need as a young person is to recognize what is productive and satisfactory and jump on it and hold on for dear life. You can come across things and they disappear and they're ephemeral and they don't catch. If you see something that you think is worth catching, then you really, really go for it.
And you said you went to grammar school. What county was that? Where did you grow up?
Yeah, it was Berkshire in Windsor.
Do they still have grammar schools? Because I'm from
Kent. They're under the Slough regime, who still have grammar schools. Yeah, it's now Windsor Boys' School. It's still an all boys' school.
Mm.
Yeah, there was a county girls' school as well.
Mm.
And a Brigidine convent, which was full of rather smart young girls.
Mm. Yeah. And Walter Isaacson, in his biography, said Leonardo had good luck to be born out of wedlock. Do you agree with that? And if so, why?
I think if Walter, you can probably make a case for it, but I prefer not to myself. It has a few disadvantages, but a lot of people were born out of wedlock in Florence, and including children with slaves.
Mm.
It was a society, and this is a fairly trendy sort of interest at the moment. It's possible that Leonardo's mother was a slave. I think probably not, but it was entirely possible. And the young, the sort of teenagers and early 20s boys, they had a record of fathering children with slaves.
Mm.
Unsurprisingly, because they were rather kept away from women until their late 20s.
Yeah. And why would it be advantageous, though, for him to be born out of wedlock? How would that have been an advantage?
Well, I can't recall exactly what he said about that, but I would imagine it's the freedom to do different things, and the fact that you can be a maverick. As an illegitimate kid, it's much harder if he's off in Florence with his father learning to be a notary.
Yeah.
And acquiring various wives himself, it would be a rather different picture.
Yeah, he might have had that expectation if he was with his father to like become a lawyer and follow that footsteps, but I guess because there wasn't that, it allowed him to follow what he was genuinely interested in, which may have not been the case if it was, if he was
His father, to do him credit, introduced him to Andrea del Verrocchio, who was the sculptor in Florence at that time, also a painter and maker of terracottas and so on, very diverse and interesting creative Florentine. And he would have paid a small sum for Leonardo to be apprenticed. And he was still in the studio of Verrocchio. A legal document says that his star, Andrea del Verrocchio, stays with. That's to say, he lived with him and was in the building, in the studio, in that we know which building they represented, because Leonardo's father, the lawyer, was involved in the sale of the property to Verrocchio. It's a small place, Florence.
Mm. Yeah. And
no, his father's want their sons to go into the same profession, but he couldn't because he was illegitimate.
Mm.
There's no sense that there's friction between the father and that.
Mm.
Being apprenticed to Verrocchio, who is the top of the profession, was not a passing thing to do.
Yeah. And how much time did he spend with his father? What you said there's no tension in the relationship, but did they have a real father-son relationship?
We absolutely don't know.
Okay.
That's extraordinary. Leonardo, we got all these thousands of pages of notes, and there's hardly an expression of inner angst or hardly a very personal expression. He writes very lively and provocative way, but he doesn't open his soul. Michelangelo is quite different.
Mm.
Michelangelo wrote impassioned letters. He wrote poetry, which was set to music, as he recognized as a poet. And he complained about everything from conditions in Florence to the quality of cheese in Rome. Michelangelo is a kind of professional complainer.
Yeah.
But Michelangelo, there's no problem of finding insights into his temperament, personality, his irascibility. Leonardo is described as being very charming, very good-looking, and well-dressed and refined.
Mm.
But that's an exterior direction. What is going on in his brain is a hell of a lot of things about nature, but not about his nature.
Mm. And does that mean we don't know if there was a dark side to Leonardo da Vinci, or we don't know what it was? Has there been nothing said?
You can infer it from drawings if you wish to do so. You go to the end of his life, and there were these visions of destruction, the drawings of tempests, great water rushes, and so on. These rocks are thrown in the air, and the air becomes full of dust and rain, and so on. Extraordinarily expressive drawings. Now, what do we deduce from that? Is he really saying that I can really do a tempest? For his treatise on painting, he's going to write how to do a fortuna, a tempest. Hmm. Is this an objective or a kind of very conscious exposition of the violence of nature? Or is it, as you suggested, an inner turmoil of his own? We actually don't know.
Hmm. So interesting. If only we could know. How did Da Vinci view fame? Was he actually famous when he was alive, or was it all accumulated afterwards?
No, he's terrifically famous when he's alive. And there are signs of that early on, because as a young man, when he's just probably come out of the studio of Verrocchio, he gets the commission for the Virgin Child and Saints, a big altarpiece in the Sala del Gran Consiglio, the council hall in Florence, in what now is called the Palazzo. And that was a prestigious commission. It's as prestigious as altarpiece commissions come. And as far as we know, he did nothing about it. We got no sign that he got a long way with that. He was off to Milan later, and we got no clue at all. But that was a prestigious commission to have.
Mm.
I think it was evident right from the beginning that he drew like an angel, and that, yeah, he was the first of what I call the super artists. in the Renaissance, you see this gradual increase in the status of artists from being craftsmen paid sort of standard rates to being recognized as ingenia, as people with talent and outstanding, not genius quite, but certainly with real stature in their own account.
Mm.
And he was one of the first of the super artists, is Leonardo Michelangelo, and Andrea Mantegna, who's less well known but is a great, great artist. They live like gentlemen.
Yeah.
Even Michelangelo's pose as a gentleman was not entirely convincing. He's rather not very interested in sartorial matters as far as we can gather, but he was interested in his status.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's the first time you're getting artists who are trying to push themselves along, not only artistically in financial terms, but in terms of society. Raphael builds a palace in Rome and he lives like a gentleman. Michelangelo's got the Casa Buonarroti, which is now a museum in Florence and is a pretty big townhouse. And he owned a whole series of farms as well. And and Leonardo was not short of a penny or two. His salary was, when he was in France, the last 3 years of his life was huge.
Yeah. And why did artists have this increase in status? What were some of the cultural reasons for that shift?
Difficult. Obviously, you've got prestige in being a good writer, particularly in Florence, which Florentines considered their Italian to be the proper Italian. There's Dante, Boccaccio, and other later authors. And Leonardo was involved with some of the poets, and he knew his Dante pretty well. But the big figures in from 1500, no, let's say 1474 to 1574, the big figures were probably the artists, socially ambitious. And I'm not quite sure what the dynamo was driving that. You can witness it happening very strikingly. But Michelangelo is quite uppity with patrons, and there's a report on Mantegna, who I said is one of the leading ones, and somebody says these artists are a bit bizarre and you have to cultivate them. They were getting reputations for being a bit big for their boots.
Yeah. And I've seen you say there's a privacy to Leonardo which draws people in. Why is there a privacy? Could you explain? Is it to do with his lack of introspection about certain topics like we were discussing earlier?
It's a complicated matter. It's a privacy which is personal, but it also relies upon his sense as to how our senses work in relation to the world. So if we look at Mona Lisa, for instance, I've aligned her with some of the love poetry written by Dante and related people. And they actually wrote poetry about Leonardo's pictures. And the women in the, whether it's Dante's Beatrice or Petrarch's Laura, they're always a bit out of reach. They may be married, they may be different class, there may be not an opportunity to meet. So you get these very enigmatic women who are the subject of this fervent love, often a love which is very cooked up, as it were, but it's nonetheless expressive for all that. And they are, because they're remote, because the artist doesn't have that direct recourse to their presence, they become mysterious and direct. There's also an optical thing that the Mona Lisa is one of the earliest pictures that has a very blurred technique of painting, lots of oil and not much pigment, and layering all this paint on, so it becomes a very elusive surface. So the women are ambiguous to see and they're ambiguous to deal with. So the poetic side and the optics, in a sense, go hand in hand. The optics say seeing is a very difficult business, very slippery. And the poets are saying being in love is a very difficult business and very slippery. So there's kind of complementary aspect to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what are some of Da Vinci's craziest ideas and inventions? I know there's some famous ones. But...
Yeah, the initial, when he became a practicing designer of machines, particularly machines for war, a lot of them imitate or pick up themes in Roman antiquity, descriptions of incredible weapon systems. If we look at a number of Leonardo's most elaborate drawings when he early on in his career as a military designer, they are wildly improbable. The so-called tank, for instance, where you've got this round base, it's like a round basin. You've got wheels and you've got cranks and you've got a top and you've got guns around the edge. Completely barmy. You know, if you think of the poor guys in there trying to fire the cannons in that confined space, they wouldn't, their ears would have been blasted away after one volley of shots. No, yeah, the whole thing. And Leonardo admits that sometimes these weapons do more damage to your friends than your enemies. So there's a lot of visual boasting goes on in these things, which means that they're doing weapons that are probably wildly improbable. He also hopes early in the system that the dynamic law is fairly simple. If you push something twice as hard, it will go twice as far. And if you make it twice as heavy, it will go half as far. He thinks that's mathematics. It's terrific. It's like perspective. You know, it diminishes or gets wider according to a pyramidal rule. And he realizes, of course, this isn't the case. As he realizes that if he had a gun shooting a pea, that the distance it went would be almost infinite, and it would be at a speed which is unthinkable. And he knew enough to know that that wasn't how guns worked. So there is a sense, as he gets closer to the phenomena during the course of his life, so he realizes they're more complicated.
Mm.
He starts off as a young man thinking that seeing is essentially a straightforward business. It's geometrical. You look at something, it's out there. You can measure the angle at which it's looked at. If you record that angle, the things will sit in the right place in your painting. You can do perspectives, grids, and you can locate figures on them and so on. And that's a kind of rational mathematics of the scale at which you see things, when you see them far away, near. You see them going across in front of the eyes and so on. And he begins to get worried that this actually doesn't work all that well, now that you don't look in that sense. I mean, David Hockney's made an enormous profession of saying that perspective doesn't work. And Leonardo would have agreed with him in some respects.
Mm.
But you've got that confidence. You say, it's geometrical seeing. I'll look at something. I'll record what it looks like. I'll record its distance. I'll do its proportions. It's easy, blokes. You just put the work in. What he realized was that the eye is a very complex mechanism. He got that from Islamic science via some Western authors, including John Peckham and Roger Bacon, that seeing is a slippery business. We see contrasts and they throw out the perception of form and so on. If something moves too fast, you don't see it. There are a whole series of what in Latin would be called deceptiones visus, visual deceptions, which mean that that seeing is not just straightforward. It's full of all sorts of ambiguities and problems. And by the end of his life, a lot of his cherished ideas, the ubiquity of perspective has crumbled to a degree. And if you think about late pictures of Virgin Child and Stan the St. John, there's no perspective.
Mm-hmm.
There's no linear perspective, no geometry.
Why is that the case?
Well, although he thinks the artist should practice perspective and be good at it, that the actual looking at something in nature, it's a gross simplification of what is a very, very complex organism and a very complex mental system for interpreting it.
Hmm.
There's an element of uncertainty in late Leonardo's science. Like modern laws of uncertainty in physics. There's quite an analogous thing going on. They're cast in completely different ways. But Leonardo knows a lot of the simple mathematical laws don't apply in practice. You've got friction, you've got all sorts of other things coming in. So there's a trajectory from, which is common enough in clever young people. They're very bright and they say, oh yeah, I can solve that. It's simply perspective. Saying, well, there's a problem with that. So there is a development of of his confidence and his lack of confidence.
Mm. And is that just that wisdom? Is that, to quote him, wisdom is the daughter of experience? Is that nuance discovered through his experience, and that's why it came later in his career and life, where he started to not disregard perspective but not follow it as much?
So the disciple of experience, there is an element of testing the physical laws that go on there. For instance, he mounts two cannon upright and he puts different size charges in and then lets them go off, and he counts how high he actually counts how long they're in the air. He doesn't count how high they were, so he couldn't count that. That's experienza. And he has the same word for experience and experiment. That's an experienza which he thinks about. I don't think he ever did it. Because he would be aware that that's a fairly late thing. He would be aware that he was as likely to get mathematically inconsistent results as he was to get something that was crystalline and perfect in mathematical terms. I think he would not have expected his cannon with twice the amount of powder to throw the missile twice as high.
Mm.
He knew there were all sorts of things going on there, including in the barrel and the resistance of the air, which he's much interested in.
Yeah. And what was the rivalry and story and relationship of Da Vinci and Michelangelo?
As far as I can tell, it wasn't good. There's no obvious direct one. Those sorts of records tend not to survive. It's not like the 19th century or even earlier, where people were writing about the artist's sayings and doings and temperaments and arguments and so on. But he had an absolutely fundamental difference in what art was about. I think they both respected each other. They knew the other person was a magnificent draftsman and could do extraordinary things. But at the heart, there is these irreconcilable things. Leonardo says your knowledge comes from nature. Knowledge that perception is slippery may seem like an intellectual thing, which it is, but it comes from nature. It comes from studying the real thing. So with Leonardo, knowledge has an empirical foundation in experiments and observation. That, broadly speaking, is an Aristotelian tradition, comes from Aristotle. Rather than Plato, Michelangelo is much more inclined to be Platonic in his ideas that nature is an imperfect reflection of what is a perfect system of ideas, and that far from leading us to the truth, that a study of raw nature on her own, as it were, was not a good thing to do. That the truth lay within yourself. Leonardo couldn't have written these deeply internalized poems that Michelangelo wrote. It's just outside his emotional realm and certainly his public persona. For Michelangelo, he's excavating his own soul, to use a rather pretentious expression, but that, in a sense, is how he would see the business of writing this very fervent religious poetry. A fair amount of it directed at Vittoria Colonna, an aristocratic woman, a poet herself and a great patron of literature and the arts.
Hmm. And why did Michelangelo have that darker side and that maybe more negative side to him? What is that, innate, or is that from childhood, from what we know?
Michelangelo always seems to have been difficult, in inverted commas. You obviously don't have much evidence about his childhood as such, but there is a sense that he is known not to be very pliable. Fairly early in his career, he's painting a Madonna for Angelo Doni, who's a major patron, and Raphael lived in his house for a time. And it's a round painting, which is still in the Uffizi. And Michelangelo painted that for Doni. The benefactor sent the messenger back with a certain sum of money. I can't remember what it was now, let's say 100 florins. And Leonardo, Michelangelo, was absolutely disgusted and sent back and said, my price is now double. And he put out, he stood up to Julius, and Julius the Pope, when he's working for him in Rome in 1508 on Sistine Ceiling. Julius was a very bellicose character. He'd, he was a military pope who won back some of the territories of the church, but was a kind of warrior pope and a very fierce man. And we've got stories by Vasari about the discussions these two men had. They might not be right in literally, but they're right in spirit. Michelangelo had a terrible, he could be terrible, he could be very fierce, very, very loud and assertive in his opinions.
Mm. And what were some?
Leonardo was very, rather courtly. He dressed well and prided himself on being an elegant courtier.
Mm.
Michelangelo was more or less the opposite of that. But at the heart of it, however you align their personalities, their behaviours, the big, big thing is that one believed that art was extracted from nature. The other believes that art was extracted from the mind interacting with nature and coming up with truths.
Which one do you agree with more?
Depends. If I'm dealing with my personal relationships, I'm with Michelangelo. If I'm dealing with professional matters, and I'm Leonardo.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's that external versus internal locus of control almost. It seems that Michelangelo is saying it's coming from within and Leonardo is saying it's coming from the outside world. And it just explains a lot. It could explain a lot of the fundamental differences between them two people just from that viewpoint.
Well, Leonardo subscribed to a medieval view of the double truth. It wasn't, not everybody in the Middle Ages had it, but it was quite a potent philosophy which said that on Earth we can do what we can do on Earth. We can understand the workings of nature, etc. And we can investigate things we can see, feel, through, touch, and so on. But there was a realm outside that, the ineffable realm, which Dante's Paradiso inhabits, where perceptions don't work, where all the normal rules about distance and weight and substance and so on don't apply. And Leonardo, in a sense, subscribed to that. He said, leave be the sacred books, they're the supreme truth. And I think he had a sense that you could, as a human being, understanding things, you would get to a point after which it was ineffable, after which it wasn't subject to our rules. Therefore, there's a huge unknown. There's a lot of dark matter out there, as it were.
Mm.
I think at the end of their lives, I give a lecture when I get an actress or an actor to read out quotations from Leonardo and Michelangelo. My final sections say that basically towards the end of their lives, they'd reached the same point. They both believed that the great spiritual truths of the heaven that God has created is outside our reach. For different reasons, but they both believed in the ineffable and that the holy books were the supreme truth. You attempted to understand the holy books by applying ruthless logic or scientific measurement to them, then you'd get nowhere.
Yeah. And why did they both come to that conclusion at the end of their lives?
Old age.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot in that you've got these bouncy certainties when you're younger. And far from, as many people grow older, and I think myself included, you get to the point where you're better at recognising what you don't know than dealing with what you do know.
Mm-hmm. And what are some examples of those things that you don't know?
Well, in terms of optics and theology, there are realms in heaven, say, which are too bright, too dark, too extreme, too big. And you can't tell how far away they are because the rules of perspective don't engage. So there's a whole slew of rational explanations which are fine on Earth, and actually don't do it in heaven. When Beatrice is with Dante in Paradiso, he keeps having to help her see. The light is too bright. And he at one point analyzes a system of three mirrors in terms of perspective. And she points out that his optics won't deliver the right results because they're earthbound.
Mm.
They're not based on heavenly inspiration.
Mm.
If you want me to answer that question in terms of myself, I would dodge it quite heavily.
Yeah, it's understandable. And who is Sally and where does he fit into Leonardo's story?
Well, yes, he's a character in a strange, seems to be a bit player in his life, but is still quite a big figure in many ways. He's Gian Giacomo Capolotti, who joins as an apprentice. I imagine this is in Milan, and I imagine the Milanese father is probably keen to get Sly off his hands anyway, fixed up for him to go to Michelangelo. And you know, Sly begins by stealing and selling anything that isn't screwed down. And he steals other artists' silver point drawing instruments, which are quite valuable. And Leonardo calls him liar, thief, obstinate glutton, writes all this down as fervent declarations in his notebooks. But he is tolerated in a way. He's obviously a rogue, but we got one signed picture by him, a Salvador Mundi type picture from 1510, 1511, which suggests he's pretty good, but not blindingly brilliant. Anyway, he stays with Leonardo. Leonardo's inner household consists of a servant, and then Francesco Melzi, who's a young Milanese nobleman, Sally Gian Giacomo Capotti, who is this very chancy and dubious Milanese. Sally is in one of the poems. Sally is a devil. That's his nickname. Leonardo could have got rid of him just like that. Why he didn't is a matter of speculation. Maybe they have a sexual relationship, but we absolutely can't tell. And he's still there, pretty much present at the end of Leonardo's life, though he spent some of that time when Leonardo's in Florence, back in Florence. The French king gave big salary to Leonardo, big, big salary, and a pretty big salary to Melzi, and a pretty comfortable one for Sally. Anyway, Sally seems to have been in Milan at least as much as in Florence. And at some point, he got hold of either Major Leonardo paintings or copies of them. He died violently in 1525. I suspect his past caught up with him. And the sisters made a list of his main assets for dividing them up between them. And a series of paintings are listed, including Mona Lisa and Virgin Child and Dan, and not least the Lady on the Swan, which is a lost painting. And these appear in an illegal document where the sisters are trying to deal with the value of the estate of Leonardo. And it seems that Gian Giacomo Capotti had got hold of, either as an agent or in himself, a major group of Leonardo paintings, which he then appears to sell to the French king. These are relatively new documents which have come out, and like almost all Leonardo documents, each document solves one problem and creates three or four others. So I'm still not quite sure what's going on in those last years of his life. The paintings that Sally has are quite expensive. They're too expensive to be his second-rate copies.
Mm. And could it be that he kept Sally despite his mischievous behaviours because he saw a bit of himself in Sally?
If he did, it must have been very much below the surface, because Leonardo seems to have been gracious and effectively honest and generous-minded, very sympathetic to things. Pretty reliable description of him buying caged birds and letting them fly away. I think he had a reputation for being gracious, courtly, and well-mannered, and he's not somebody who raised his voice a great deal, I think.
Mm. So do you think maybe because of that sympathetic nature, he probably had sympathy for Salai, and that's why a reason why he let him stay?
Yeah, maybe. We can come up with a half a dozen explanations as to what the attraction was and why Salai stayed with him, including Salai's self-interest, I have to say.
Yeah. And
it's mysterious. There is now a book on the last years of Leonardo's life, which puts the cat among the pigeons, as it were. I'm still digesting the consequences of it.
And what was said in it?
Well, it was always slightly untidy. Leonardo goes to France in 1516, and we know he's got a decent number of his autograph paintings with him, because he's visited in Clos Lucé, where he's got this great manor house. He's visited in France by the Cardinal of Aragon and his touring party, and Antonio de Beatis, one of the men accompanying the Cardinal, writes a diary of what's going on. And they visit Leonardo, who's living in some splendor. They describe the works that he showed them, including Mona Lisa and the anatomical drawings, which are particularly remarkable. And but it's unclear. We don't know literally how the French king got hold of most of those Leonardo paintings. Jan Sammer, the person who wrote the book, believes that Salai has appropriated them, or Leonardo gave them to him, and he then sells them back to the French king. You can reconcile that with the documents, but you can also come up with other readings of those documents. My readings of them is that Salai is custodian, as it were, the keeper, the curator of the Leonardo paintings, rather than the supposed owner of them. But I'm not sure that's a very satisfactory explanation. But it's good that things are still coming up. And with Leonardo, you never know when he's finished with you.
Yeah. And why did he go to France? I've been lucky enough to go to Amboise many times on holiday, where he lived. It's a really nice place. And what was the reason why he moved from Italy to that region of the Loire?
Leonardo needed patrons, or above all, he needed a patron. His record on earning things in a hand-to-mouth existence in a republic wasn't very good. He came back from Milan the first time with a fair amount of money, and he documents the gradual diminution of his bank account, as it were, as he wasn't getting that much paid employment in Florence, which was rather at war at that point anyway. He worked best in a court situation where basically he was an ornament of the court and he was allowed to do, to some extent, what he wanted to. Foyle Moro, Ludovico Sforza, his main patron in Milan, clearly gave him a lot of latitude, and he could play music, he could stage theatrical displays, etc., etc. So he wanted that kind of patron rather than one who paid by the yard, paid for the paintings by size and quality and so on.
And a lot of people think Da Vinci is history's greatest genius. What is your opinion on that, and what are some other contenders?
Yeah, it depends. It depends on your criteria. This is a very academic thing to say, but are we looking at enormously productive things which fit seamlessly into our notions of the advance of science and technology? And the answer is no, basically. If you look at someone like Edison with his great invented campus in America, and every drawing he and his people write is initialed and dated. And that's an extraordinary enterprise of entrepreneurialism and science and engineering. With Leonardo, the picture is almost exactly the reverse of that, of things which are not entering common currency and not being picked up. Leonardo, it's not particularly productive to write about the influence of him as a science or technologist. It is there, but it's not what justifies still reading him. If you're wishing to say, is there anybody who could see so much unity, affinity, and common cause in nature, and is important, draw it like an angel, get pictures to make these points. And he's probably the greatest at that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about his paintings, people say to me, he didn't finish many paintings. I say, oh, well, he finished the Mona Lisa, that's the world's most famous painting. He finished the Last Supper, which is could be the second most famous. And what's the most famous drawing? Yeah, the Vitruvian Man, yeah. And I say that's not bad.
Yeah, not bad at all. And I want to talk a bit about the way he operated when he was painting, or at least with the Last Supper. I've read that he would often spend from dusk till dawn not eating and drinking and working on it. And then another day he would just be staring at it, criticizing himself. And then another day he'd come in at noon and do two strokes, then leave. Is that, do you think that's true? And how does that reflect on how we think we're meant to work and operate? And why do you think he worked like that?
It's very interesting and plausible, but one of the things the historian has to do is ask about the source. In this case, the source is pretty good. It's reasonably impeccable. Bandello, the novelist, when he's talking about Leonardo and the scaffolding, he'd go into the Fetchery of Santa Maria della Grazia, and as you say, he would go up on the scaffolding and he'd just look at it like it was some kind of enemy or something, do a few touches and go away. Another time he'd really get very, very, very productively going at it. So it's a heavily thought through picture in terms of all the gestures, expressions, movements, dynamics of the composition, the iconography of it, the meanings of it, and so on. It's a very extraordinarily carefully thought through picture, which relies upon optics and anatomy and all manner of things going on.
Yeah. And what does...
I think Bandello is important because he's somebody who writes well, who's got no reason to say anything about Leonardo.
Mm.
There's a parallel there, I think, with Titian, interestingly. Very different painters, but I think it's Paolo Giovio later in Titian's life says he has lots of pictures on the go at any one time, and most of them are turned with their face to the wall. And he'll get one turned round and he'll look at it as if it's his worst enemy and do something with the picture, and back it goes the other way around again. And Michelangelo, of course, carved the late carvings. You couldn't get figures out of the block. He carved into the block, particularly the Rotondi Pietà in Milan. He carved so much into that you couldn't get a figure out of it.
Mm.
The late Michelangelo crucifixion drawings, there's a drawings exhibition in British Museum recently. Late crucifixion drawings, dematerialized drawing. So there are these ghostly traces on paper of these visions of the dead Christ opening his arms from, on the cross to Michelangelo. So, they're people, Michelangelo, Leonardo. So at the end of their life, I think they got to common positions in a way, but they're excavating as deep as they can go, in Leonardo's case by looking at nature, and in Michelangelo's case by inspecting his divine soul, or maybe not too divine in many of his interpretations.
Mm. Yeah. Why is that effective, the approach that Titian and Da Vinci took, where they would be hypercritical, they wouldn't look at it, they'd forget about it, and then they would add something to it later? Because as a young person, we seem to be advised to just work, just get it done, like get on with it. But it seems that these two great painters actually did the opposite of that. They took their time and they spent time away from it, and then did the smallest little retouch and then forgot about it again or went away. So what does that tell us about?
Yeah, well, I think it's hugely individual, but in relation to the artist, it's difficult to draw out rules against what you're describing. Leonardo, Michelangelo, put Raphael. Raphael, a superbly productive professional. There was a big Raphael show at the National Gallery again relatively recently. You got a real sense of somebody who's a wonderful professional picture maker. And I don't mean that in a derogatory sense, but that he got the brief to do a picture.
Mm.
No, what you tend to find is if Leonard was briefed to do a picture, he'd get hooked on the horse in the background and spend a lot of time portraying horses galloping across landscapes or something like that. With Raphael, it's a production process of involving great genius, great invention, great style, great quality, great narrative sense. But it's done with extraordinarily measured professionalism.
Mm.
Without as much, as far as we can tell, the kind of angst which Michelangelo expressed and Leonardo suppressed.
Mm. That reminds me of...
You can then take somebody like Giorgio Vasari, who wrote The Lives of the Artists. And he was the first Grand Duke Cosimo in Florence, Cosimo de' Medici. He was the chief painter for him and wrote The Lives of the Artists. So we know a lot about what Vasari thought about in art. And he covered walls with frescoes at a fantastic pace. You may say the result's not as good as Michelangelo, which is true, they're not as good as Raphael or Leonardo. Nonetheless, he was an absolutely top professional artist and certainly didn't get himself tangled up with psychological inadequacies.
Mm. Yeah, so it's really dependent on the person and a bit of a stark contrast. But when you're saying about Raphael's output and process, it kind of reminded me a bit of, in some ways, Warhol's, in the sense that it was almost, for Warhol, it was like just quite a factory-like process, right? And so I guess it really depends on the artist. You know, some artists is hypercritical and slow, than others focused on getting as much out in as little time.
Yeah, Warhol is quite interesting in that respect because Verrocchio had this studio. He was a marble sculptor first and foremost. That's where his big reputation came. But he did, well, there were paintings done in his studio. There were terracottas. He did armor, parade armor, and so on. And Leonardo grew up in that studio. And I think the senior painters were like foremen, that they would take up bits of Verrocchio's painting and make something out of them. And Leonardo's pupils did that. It's becoming perfectly clear that there's a group of Leonardisti, Leonardo followers in Milan, who are basically making Leonardos. Some of them are in the studio and they use cartoons, the full-scale drawings. They use the repertoire of Verrocchio's drawings of different things, Leonardo's drawings of different things, some of the best-known compositions of children and the Virgin are designed by Leonardo but painted by somebody else.
Mm.
So the studio could be like a factory in that sense.
Mm.
David Hockney has got computing people working for him at the moment. He's putting out these enormous yardage of absolutely spectacular painting. But that's it's a business process, and I don't mean that rudely. It's a business of production.
Mm. Yeah.
I think one of the things you learn with art, whether it's musicians, whether it's poets, whatever, is that it's fantastically difficult to generalize.
Yes.
As soon as you make a rule, somebody will come along and do something which doesn't fit.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it, in a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. And Da Vinci quotes saying, in his manuscript, all hurts leave a pain in the memory except for the greatest hurt of all, which is death, which kills the memory along with life. How did Da Vinci die?
Are you sure that's a real quotation?
It might. Well, I mean, you'll know more than me. I read it in one of his biographies. I thought he wrote it in one of his manuscripts. Am I incorrect in saying that?
Well, you may be very right now. Maybe you've been very ignorant, but I don't know it.
I think it was when there's this point in his life from the biography I read where this lady called Caterina was like came to stay with him or something, and they're not sure if it was his mother. Have you read anything similar about that?
Oh yeah, there's a note in Leonardo, I think 1494. He said Caterina came to stay, and there's then an entry not long after in the Libro dei Morti, the book of the dead in Milan that records dead people. There's Caterina da Firenze from Florence, which is what they would say in in Lombardy, they wouldn't say from Vinci. Then it does look as if his mother, after the death of her husband, came to stay with Leonardo in Milan. But characteristically, Leonardo writes nothing about this, apart from that Caterina came to stay. His own father's death was recorded as if it was a libera de morti. He says, on this day, my father, Sir Piero da Vinci, died, etc., etc. It's a very cool, objective record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Leonardo doesn't let his guard slip at all. He's a very private person.
Mm-hmm.
In that respect. But the quotation I'm rather suspicious of, but if it's right, then I've learned something, which is good.
What about this one? Because this was I think the period that we're talking about, apparently he said the wisdom is the daughter of experience. And then also on the page I read, it also said, this is the supreme folly of man. He stints himself now so he will not have to stint later. And his life flies away before he can enjoy the good things he's labored so much to acquire. Have you read that, him saying that before? Or?
First bit, I definitely know. The second bit certainly rings strong bells. It's right in line with these. Much Leonardo writes these sort of 3-4 liners, which sometimes are called prophecies. And they have kind of ready wit. Don't mean wit in the sense of ha-ha, but wit in terms of ingenuity.
Mm. Yeah. And how did Da Vinci die, and how did he view death from what we know?
It seems likely he had a stroke some beforehand, because Antonio de Beatis, the man I've already mentioned as the secretary to the cardinal who was going around and doing his grand tour of Europe, he records that Leonardo had paralysis down one side of his body. He says with his right hand, and that he wouldn't be able to paint well again. I'm not sure. The right and left hand probably get a bit confused there, but it seems likely he had a stroke and probably had another one.
Mm.
Supposedly died in the arms of Francis I, but Francis I was elsewhere at the time.
And how is there any evidence of his actual view on death from his manuscripts and his journals?
Yes, in the anatomical drawings and so on, he's interested in death and sepulchres and so on. But he doesn't feed it back into the feelings of his own life. Michelangelo is talking about his two deaths, the death of his body and death of his spirit. Michelangelo addresses his coming death. He's quite an old man by that time. He addresses it very fervently and very directly. With Leonardo, there's no great sign of that. Vasari, he writes this very picturesque biography of Leonardo, which is rather good. Imagines Leonardo on his deathbed repenting that he hadn't done all the things he should have done. We don't know that. Now, the Vasari life of Leonardo is interesting, because Vasari is an interesting and important figure, an interesting writer, and it paints a very, very good picture of Leonardo. Yeah, everybody should read it, because I've done an edition of it. So,
Definitely. And does what we know indicate that Michelangelo was more introspective about himself? Is that a conclusion that we can take?
Yeah, absolutely. Leonardo, given, as I said, these thousands of pages of notes, is about as unintrospective, if there is such a word, as you can imagine.
Mm. What about Raphael?
We have relatively little in the way of personal sources of Raphael. He was the son of a painter who died when he was very young. I think that he was listed in a contract to the master in 1500. Now, he was born in 1483, so 17 years old, he's already qualified as an independent artist. And I think keeps some of his father's studio going through his initial early commissions. Yeah, Raphael seems to have been remarkably difficult for a biographer, I think. You could concoct things, but there's very little to go on.
Mm-hmm.
We perhaps shouldn't be altogether surprised. artists at this time are only just beginning to become focuses of high-level writing and analysis. Donatello, who's the most wonderfully expressive artist, hugely accomplished, does great projects. Clearly, he's got a very strong personality. We know almost nothing about him.
Wow.
Now, that was the norm, however famous you were. In Lesky, there's a nice early biography, which is fairly descriptive. So Brunelleschi built the dome of the cathedral, so he was a big achiever, very prominent in the public eye. Now, artist biographies are not really written. First group of artist biographies are about Paolo Jovio, who had a museum of portraits of people, not least artists. And he wrote pen sketches of the artists, which the one on Leonardo is very picturesque and good. But we're at that cusp where artists become of importance to be thought of in human beings as living, breathing, thinking, weeping, laughing. You simply don't find that in the earlier ones.
Yeah. And what are some of the most well-known artists from the medieval era, or the most famous names from that period of time?
One of the characteristics of the Middle Ages is that artists' names are often not preserved. We've got the tradition to it becomes slightly the 14th century. Becomes somewhat more different. But the artists who did these wonderful tombs and so on in Gothic buildings, they're often not known. Most of you might have a contract. With Giotto is the first artist who becomes a big man, I'll use the term man advisedly, the important figure, which painters on the whole didn't. There were people who made beautiful objects, but they were not considerable in their own right. He designed and built the bell tower of the cathedral. A great frescoist, a great painter, religious frescoist, one of the greatest of all. This summer, I was looking at the Scrovegni Chapel in Padua, which is this amazing private chapel, come mausoleum. There was a cycle of biblical cycles on the walls. Just extraordinary. And Giotto became famous. He was called an ingenium, more or less a genius in our terms.
Mm-hmm. And
the contemporaries of his, the Pisano family, the sculptors, very well known.
What made the medieval and the Middle Ages different to the Renaissance in that sense? Why weren't there being signed artists, or the artists having their name signed on things? And was that actually a regression that people stereotypically think in terms of artwork and innovation?
Yeah, it's difficult to come up with a notion of what probably is a multi-layered phenomenon. Michael Baxendall, I think sadly died, wrote a very good book on looking at the status of the artist. And that gradual rise, they gradually written about in various kinds of literature, including accounts of towns I've not got a developed, overarching explanation as to why this personalization of artists occurred. But it didn't. It's very potent. It's a bit like Burckhardt and the Rise of the Individual, which I think is in the Renaissance. To some extent, it's the rise of the individual because people record them, not because they weren't rising individuals before.
Yeah. And what advice do you think Da Vinci would give to a young person today?
Look at nature.
Do you think most things can be learnt from doing that?
Well, he would argue that nature is the creation of God. It's been suggested he's atheist, which is complete nonsense. But he would say if you understood a part of nature, you could go and understand a related part of nature and so on, then there would be a kind of expanding field of related knowledge. But above all, it's experience, experiment, you're probing nature for its truths. As I said, in later life, he regarded those truths as rather slippery, but nonetheless, that was the quest which we could do on Earth. Trying to imagine the bliss of souls in paradise was was beyond human imagination. I think Michelangelo would have agreed with that, surprisingly enough.
Yeah. And what are the things that you've learned from studying Da Vinci that have changed the way you've lived and think?
I'm not sure anything which has changed the way I live in that sort of material sense, but it's given me a very strong sense that the scope of art, its relationship to seen things, is inexhaustible and extraordinary. There was a sense in when Vasari's writing towards the end of the Renaissance that everything had been done. You know, you got Leonardo, Michelangelo, Raphael, what more is there to do? Of course, you've then got Caravaggio and Rembrandt and so on, who are not bad. So there is always, if you're looking at your materials, you're looking at nature, the interaction of your skills, materials, and what you can see is endlessly fertile.
Yeah. And as a final question, if you could give your 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would that advice be?
20 years old, let's think. I can come up with a generalization. One of them would be try hard. But the other, don't write something off early because it looks impossible.
Yeah.
Rather pretentious, but I think.
No. Very good advice. Very, very good advice. I think fellow Brits will probably understand this. We have this inbuilt almost cynicism and negativity or pessimism in our culture where, you know, we think a lot of things are impossible and a lot of dreams are impossible. So that advice really, really resonates and I appreciate it. And the audience definitely does as well.
Okay.
Martin Kemp, ladies and gentlemen. Martin, really appreciated this. And thank you so much for enlightening myself and the audience on the incredible man that is Leonardo da Vinci, and also a lot about Michelangelo as well. Is someone that I need to study a bit more. So yeah, I really appreciate it.
It's a great pleasure. You know, being asked to think about such things is A, taxing, and B, very rewarding.
Mm. Where can people go if they want to find your work?
My writings?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, all in good bookshops, I would say, libraries and so on.
Awesome.
Overall, I've written a lot about art and science, and I wrote in a column in Nature, the science magazine, for more than a dozen years. So I write a lot about the interface of art and science, and I write about contemporary artists as well. So it's an absurdly big bibliography.
Mm, definitely. I'll try and leave as many links to your work in the show notes so people can directly check it out on the internet. Yeah, thank you so much, Martin. Really appreciate this.
Okay, Jacob, it's a great pleasure and scrambles my brain.
Awesome. If you've made it this far, you're likely not just a listener, you're ready to be the host. You felt that sense of intimacy and connection with our guest today, and you would like to get the same on your own show and start your own dream show. But you're worried about landing dream guests and all the complications and the mess that is often spoken about when starting your own podcast from scratch. You think starting a podcast requires a huge budget and a whole team, right? That is absolute nonsense. My Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is the ultimate key to skipping the outdated advice and building a high quality, high impact show, even for under $100. It provides the proven strategies and AI templates that I use this day that you will be able to use to reclaim your time and creative control. And this is a strictly limited opportunity. Don't dilly-dally because there's limited spaces. We've already got one student, Rob, who's joined. That means there's only a couple more spaces to get the Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint course half price. And you need to act very, very fast because this is a limited offer and you're very, very early. So if you want to get the early bird discount like Rob has and get the results by watching the course that goes through the exact step-by-step blueprint that I use to this day to create these episodes that you've just watched and get the success and become Europe's fastest growing under 21 podcaster, and also join live weekly calls with me and use the AI templates and email templates that I use every single day to get the results and just get all my secrets without getting any of the mistakes and failures that I've made, then top link in the description is for you. And if you're ready to launch your own show and get personalized one-to-one help from me and copy my blueprint, which no other podcaster has shared, then I'll see you there. I'm rooting for you. Goodbye. Hope you enjoyed the episode too.